Welcome to the Red Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thanks for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those just might change how we read or read into scripture. Last week, we talked about Hezekiah, and he is regarded as one of, if not the most righteous kings that Israel ever had. But he ruled during a politically tumultuous time. When he was on the throne, Neo-Assyria was working very hard to conquer all of the Levant on their way to Egypt, because that's really what Neo-Assyrians wanted, was to be the only empire in town. At that time, Hezekiah got together with some other kings, the Phoenician king of Sidon, and also the Philistine kings of Ashkelon and Gaza. They partnered up with the Egyptian pharaoh at that time to come against the Neo-Assyrians, and that did not go well. In 701, a king named Sennacherib came down, and he ended up conquering all of the southern kingdom, with the exception of Jerusalem. But he didn't leave Jerusalem alone. Hezekiah agreed to pay heavy tribute that would continue long after he was dead. Well, so when Hezekiah died, he was followed by his son Manasseh. And so Manasseh, it says, reigned for 55 years, and then he came to the throne when he was 12. There's a little bit of disagreement among people as to whether or not he purely ruled by himself for 55 years, or if possibly he was part of a regency. Maybe when he was 12, when he was younger, he was ruling during that time period when the Bible says Hezekiah was ill. But regardless, Manasseh came to the throne when he was 12 years old, and he was technically king for 55 years. In 687, was when he really took over. And at that point, the southern kingdom and specifically Jerusalem, it is at this crossroads in between Egypt and the Neo-Assyrian Empire. By 681, the balance of power was starting to shift, actually, in the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Sennacherib ends up getting murdered, and he is replaced by one of his sons named Esarhaddon. So Esarhaddon is going to be one of the main guys that we are talking about today. He ends up going and making several incursions into Egypt, and he is ultimately successful in conquering them in 671. He does what all Neo-Assyrian kings did, and he writes about it. He creates a victory stela, and on this, he is shown towering over two smaller figures. The larger of the two small figures is actually, we think, supposed to be the king of Egypt at the time, a pharaoh named Taharqa. And then the smaller one, we think, is Taharqa's son. He is shown wearing the blue crown, whereas Taharqa is himself wearing the white crown of Upper Egypt. And if you listen to last season's podcast, which was all about Egypt and Egypt's interactions with Israel, then you may remember that Upper Egypt is actually in the south. Egypt is, it kind of feels like their directions are flipped a little bit. Upper Egypt is in the south, Lower Egypt is in the north, and that's because that is the direction that the Nile River flows. The Nile River flows from south to north, emptying into the Mediterranean. So anyway, he's wearing the white crown of Upper Egypt, which would have been the southern region of Egypt, also known as Nubia, at certain points in their history. Well, so Esarhaddon, in 669, he hears that there's some revolting happening in Egypt. Neo-Assyria had a lot of difficulty holding on to Egypt, so this wasn't really surprising. And Esarhaddon heads back down to Egypt in an attempt to quell the rebellion that is happening there. He actually ends up dying along the way. And when he dies, his son, Ashurbanipal, ends up coming to the Neo-Assyrian Empire, coming to their throne, and taking it over in Nineveh. He continued struggling with Egypt. Ashurbanipal did. And he actually ends up founding a new dynasty in Egypt. He puts a puppet king on the throne there. And then we have some, or we read about some stability between Egypt and the Neo-Assyrians at that point, because he is just a puppet king of Neo-Assyria that is over Egypt at that time. This is the beginnings of things to come. We're going to talk a little bit more about everything that's going on in Neo-Assyria this week, but we're really going to talk about the fall of the empire beginning next week and those additional interactions with Egypt. Well, so King Manasseh, he is ruling when all this stuff is going on. And his story is told in 2 Kings 21 and in 2 Chronicles 33. It's in this first verse, the very first verse of the description. We read he's 12 when he comes to the throne. He rules for 55 years. But it turns out that this is actually a really big problem for the people who are writing scripture. They're writing the historical books of the Bible. And the problem is, why would God allow a man who is about to be described as being so thoroughly evil, why would he be allowed to stay on the throne for 55 years? If you go and visit Tel Lachish, which I hope everyone gets to do at some point, they have this really neat art installation there. And I guess it's a big tell. It takes a while to walk around all of it. Maybe people can get tired. I don't know. But what they've done is they have set up chairs, thrones, and the heights of the backs of those thrones represent the heights or the lengths that all of Israel's kings ruled. Northern Kingdom, Southern Kingdom, all of them, they're all there. And when you just look at that, you can see that Manasseh's chair towers over all of the others that are there. I mean, he ruled 15 years longer than David did, 15 years longer than Solomon did. So the two who are held up as the best kings in the history of Israel was outruled by 15 years by somebody who seems to be the worst, especially if you only look at the king's account of everything that he did. Well, so according to the one chapter that he's given in Kings, that's something else that's a little bit surprising. He reigned for 55 years, but not a whole lot got written about him in the book of Kings. Well, in that book, we read that he basically spent his time trying to reverse all of the religious reforms that his father, Hezekiah, had put into place. He rebuilds the high places. He restores the worship of Baal and Asherah. He starts facilitating the worship of even other gods inside of the temple. He practices every form of magic that it seems he could even think of, necromancy, fortune telling, all of that stuff, which God absolutely hates and abhors. He's doing all of those things. And there's a line in there that he just murders innocent Jerusalemites. We don't know why. There's no context there. Was it political? Was it religiously motivated? We don't know. But probably what is the most shocking thing of all, it says that he does, is in 21:6, it says that Manasseh forced his son to go through the fire as a burnt offering. On the surface, this seems to be a description of child sacrifice. And if this is a passage that you studied before, you may have heard that people will say that he was worshiping a god named Molech. But I want to point out that the text does not say that. The tradition that he was sacrificing to Molech actually comes from a place of people reading the Bible wanting to fill in those blanks. So little is written about Manasseh. We have so many questions that, you know, naturally we go to other places in the Bible and try to figure out what they're talking about. Well, 2 Kings 21:6 is not specific. It doesn't say that he returned to the gods of the Canaanites. It doesn't say that he started worshiping the Phoenician gods after Jezebel. It also doesn't say that he embraced the gods of the Assyrians, which that might be what we expect to be happening here more than anything else, because traditionally when empires come in and take over a region, they try to assimilate cultures. And so you see the blendings of gods and that sort of thing. Well, that's not mentioned there either. We simply don't know why he passed his son through the fire. But don't assume it was Molech. In fact, that Molech is a topic for an entirely different podcast, but I just want to point out that it does not say that. And odds are Molech was not at all involved in what was happening here. Well, so the accusations that are made are the absolute worst of the worst. And I think the holes that are left in there and the brevity really indicates that the writers of Kings were just wanting to move past Manasseh. When they're sitting down and they're writing the history of Israel, they just want to get past this guy and get to the next good king, who is Josiah. So I tend to think that is why Kings presents Manasseh in the way that it does. So the second account of King Manasseh, or maybe the second part of the story, actually comes in 2 Chronicles 33. And what we read there is actually a redemption story. We will talk about Chronicles and where they came from and how they were created in the last episode of the season. But for today's purposes, we need to understand that the books of Chronicles are fundamentally different from the book of Kings. Samuel and Kings are just nitty-gritty historical sources. They give us the good and the bad and the ugly. In Samuel and Kings, you hear all the good and bad that, for example, King David and King Solomon did. Whereas when you go over to Chronicles, typically the bad stuff gets left out, especially when the chronicler is talking about a good king. So, as I said in earlier episodes, Samuel and Kings, they're sort of the court records that really, really is history. But the book of Chronicles is, it was written later. It was written probably during the fourth century. It was written after the exile. And so because it was written so much later, and because it was written after the exile, it is actually not included in the historical books of the Bible. If you go to the Hebrew Bible, to the Jewish Bible, their Bibles actually end with Chronicles. Chronicles is considered wisdom literature because the people who were writing it, they have this intense focus really on the theology. They are retelling the history of Israel, but they are doing it with a purpose. They are doing it knowing that the people who are going to be reading these words and reading about the history of their nation are in the process of rebuilding that nation, and they need to be motivated and they need to be reminded of all of the good parts of Israel's history. And so you have that vein flowing through the books of Chronicles that you don't have in Samuel and Kings, which tend to just be more strict history. So 2 Chronicles 33:11 begins the story of Manasseh's capture. We read about the Neo-Syrian king's army coming and shackling him as if he were a slave and taking him to the city of Babylon. And this city was part of the Neo-Assyrian Empire at this time, and it happened to be ruled by Esarhaddon's brother at that point. While he is in captivity in Babylon, he prays for forgiveness very genuinely, and it is granted by God. He ends up going back to Jerusalem, and while he is there, he starts reversing his own policies and trying to return the country back to what it was like when Hezekiah was ruling. He is there trying to return right worship of God to his people. It says that he fortified Jerusalem and then also some of Judah's other cities. We don't really know what that means because of the political situation at the time, but he starts investing in fortifications, which is always a good thing. But all of this seems to be too little too late. The people do not completely end up returning to pure monotheistic worship of only Israel's God at this point in time. Well, so where does the story come from? If it's in Chronicles, which was written later, and it's not involved in the Book of Kings at all, where did it come from? Well, the chronicler very helpfully puts a little footnote in there for us. And it says that that the story, maybe not just this story, but it tells us to go to two other sources to learn more about Manasseh. And those are the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and the Chronicles of Hosea. These are documents that we do not have. In fact, none of these chronicles that are mentioned, especially in the Book of Kings, none of those have ever been found that we know of. I hope they're out there somewhere because they obviously include so much history, so many amazing stories that we don't have today. But wherever the story came from, if it was from one of those two, what it does is it gives the chronicler sort of a solution to the problem of why Decision Evil King get to rule for so long. And that answer is that he actually did. He turned around his life. He prayed for forgiveness and he tried to right the ship. And so that is sort of the implication that is what is trying to be conveyed there, is that he is rewarded with long life because of the change that he tried to make in this episode that we get just from Chronicles. So when Manasseh was captured by the Neo-Assyrian army, he wasn't taken to Nineveh, as might have been expected. He wasn't taken to the seat of the empire where the king would have been. Instead, the chronicler says that he was taken to Babylon. So a lot of scholars will look at that and they will say this must be an error. They will say that the chronicler who was writing later, he was writing after the Babylonian exile, he just made a mistake. And in talking about what city he went to, the chronicler was referencing what he knew best at the time. And that's why Babylon is put there. However, historically, Neo-Assyria is going through an incredibly tumultuous time. In 669, Esarhaddon died, and he ended up leaving his oldest son, whose name was Shamashuma-Ukin. Haha, Shamashuma-Ukin. He ended up making him the king of Babylon, and then he made his younger son, Ashurbanipal, into the king of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. We don't know why Esarhaddon made these choices. You would think that the older son would have been put over the entire empire and not simply a part of the empire and just a city, not just the city of Babylon. Well, maybe it was sibling rivalry. I'm an only child. That's not something I fully understand, but presumably there was a reason that Esarhaddon set up the succession in this way. The brothers managed to keep the peace until 652, but at that point, Shamashuma-Ukin revolted. He managed to get the Babylonian people, the people who were still indigenous there, managed to get them behind him, the old Arameans, the Medes, groups of people who had been taken over by the Assyrian Empire and who maybe themselves weren't super happy with having Nineveh ruling over all of them. They ended up coming in with him and they revolted against Ashurbanipal, who was in Nineveh at the time. Well, so Ashurbanipal was able to put down the rebellion in 648. We don't have a lot of records from Babylon, the city of Babylon at that time, because after that king died, the people who remained went and they actually mutilated the records that were left behind. In fact, in the stela, you can see that the king of Babylon, his face has actually been scarred and broken off of it. Whereas next to him, the stela that is Ashurbanipal, you know, that one's in pretty good condition because he remained the king of the Assyrian Empire. Well, this really far-reaching, epic family squabble between these two brothers, even though Neo-Assyria ends up keeping control then, this really does foreshadow what is to come. And the end of the Neo-Assyrian Empire would come in 626 at the hands of the Babylonians and their good buddies, their good partners, the Medes. Join me next week when we discuss the next good king of the Southern Kingdom, Josiah. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yerimkiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.